Appearance for the record.
Your Honor, for the appellant, Doris Hines and Ron Smith.
Thank you.
Your Honor, Brian Ripple from the VA Office of General Counsel, representing the Secretary with me, Counsel for the Assistant General Counsel, Randy Campbell.
Thank you. Thank you, Honor. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, we are.
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Ms. Hines, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. 10 minutes. Please.
10 minutes. You will go first, and you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The issue before the Court today involves the statute, 38 U.S.C. Section 1318, involving survivor benefits. The language of that statute: the Secretary shall pay benefits to the surviving spouse under certain circumstances, and there are two enumerated in the statute. The surviving spouse must have been married to the veteran for more than 1 year before the veteran's death, and the veteran must have had a disability that was rated totally disabling for a period of not less than 5 years from the date of the veteran's discharge from active duty. Those two requirements of the statute have been fulfilled in this case, and there is no dispute on that issue, and the Board so found in its decision. The statutory language here in Section 1318 is mandatory. It says that benefits shall be provided and shall be paid. This Court has looked at statutes that include such mandatory language. For example, in Davenport, the Court looked at statutory language that included the same sort of provision of payments shall be made and said the language is mandatory, leaving no room for the VA to impose additional restrictions on entitlement. As a result, in the Davenport case, where the person was entitled to benefit and met the two and only two requirements of the statute, the additional requirement in the regulation in that situation, a causal link between disability and an employment handicap added in a regulation, was invalid. This Court in Lee reached a similar conclusion, and in that case, this Court struck a provision in veterans' life insurance policy that added a restriction by regulation. There, too, the statutory language was mandatory, and there was no ability of the Secretary, and this Court found the regulation was invalid because it added a restriction to a statutory provision that was otherwise mandatory.
Counsel, if I can interject, how do you overcome the construction principle that we shouldn't have an absurd result, and that somebody who, let's assume for the sake of argument, that your counsel was guilty of murdering her husband, that she then would get to benefit from that action?
Well, the question here, and that is a good question, Your Honor, there are two parts to that. The first is, in any statutory scheme, the Secretary must be given the authority to promulgate a regulation. And here that was not done. The statute is mandatory, and no authority was given to impose additional restrictions on that payment. Second, Your Honor,
assuming there was no restriction or no authority in the statute, what about common law?
Well, here, Your Honor, the common law was known clearly, and the Secretary, or excuse me, Congress, when enacting this statute, did not include that restriction. But, and what's important here, is that another restriction was put in the statute. In fact, in Section 1318B, that restriction is expressly enumerated. A deceased veteran is a veteran who dies not as a result of the veteran's own willful misconduct. So there is a restriction in the statute with respect to the veteran's own willful misconduct. There is no other restriction in the statute about anyone else's misconduct.
So, counsel, given the background of the common law and the Slayer's rule, what are we to make of that under your analysis?
Well, the conclusion is that Congress specifically intended not to make that exclusion, where here there is a restriction in the statute expressly about the veteran's own willful misconduct, but not the misconduct of anyone else. And this situation is similar to this court's decision in Gardner. Now, in Gardner, there was a statutory provision that also accepted the veteran's own willful misconduct. What this court looked at in Gardner was, should there also be, or could there also be, a fault requirement by the VA put in by regulation? And this court said no.
But was there any common law behind that?
No, there was not, Your Honor. But the analysis is similar. Here, or in Gardner, rather, this court looked at Congress specifically excluding the veteran's own willful misconduct and not specifically excluding misconduct on anyone's
part. Is common law normally overruled implicitly or directly? If you're going to have a non-application of common law, is that done by Congress implicitly or directly?
Typically, it would be done directly. And here, Your Honor, because the way the statute is written, it has been. The only restriction in the statute relates to the veteran's own willful misconduct. And the Supreme Court, in affirming the decision in Gardner, said, noted the reference to the veteran's fault and the silence as to the VA's fault, and said it is generally...
But isn't Gardner really, it's an apposite here, because the common law wasn't underpinning the fault requirement that VA added in the Gardner case. Here we have either an argument, I suppose, that the Secretary could not fill a gap, and your argument that the Federal Circuit, even though they determined that this was appropriate gap filling, didn't really address whether the Secretary had the authority. That is what I believe is your brief's argument. Or there's common law, and the Secretary came in and procedurally filled in the common law.
Well, here, Your Honor, looking at the statutory construction and the analogy to Gardner does fit in this case, notwithstanding the common law issue. Because in looking at statutory construction, the Supreme Court in Gardner says it's presumed that Congress acts intentionally and purposefully in disparate inclusion and exclusion. And in that case, the statute expressly included the veteran's own willful misconduct, just as the statute does.
Well, we accept Gardner. How does that apply to this case where you have common law existing, a statute put in place, and nothing in the statute specifically overruling the common law?
Well, here, Your Honor, the language of the statute expressly excludes or carves out only one class of individuals, and that is the class of individuals for the veteran's own willful misconduct.
Well, even assuming we accept your argument, how do we overcome the Federal Circuit's case in Lofton, where they found a gap in a very similar statute and said that a similar provision was a reasonable gap filler? So how can we find, with virtually identical language, that there is no gap here?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, in Lofton, the issue of the Secretary's authority to issue the regulation was not decided. The Federal Circuit in Lofton only looked at whether 3.11 was a reasonable gap-filling measure.
I appreciate that, but I think that's the first step of whether there's any room for the Secretary to regulate, and whether he has authority to regulate is a different question. But if you could focus on how could we find no gap here when there's a gap, according to the Federal Circuit, there?
Well, Your Honor, I believe under an analysis of the statute, the first question you look at is the authority of the Secretary. Does the Secretary have the authority to make this kind of regulation, this regulation that specifically excludes a class of people from being covered, where the statute does not exclude that class and by presumption does not exclude it because others are excluded? So the first issue is whether there is authority to make substantive rules. And here, the appellant submits, there is no substantive authority, and the Secretary has not been granted that authority.
Please indulge me, and let's assume that they have that authority, and then can we talk about how can we find that there's a gap if Lofton found no gap?
Well, if we assume that the Secretary has authority, then Lofton controls. and it is a reasonable gap-filling measure. We respectfully submit that the Secretary did not have authority, and that's the first question that must be answered before you get to the second of, is it a reasonable gap-filling measure? I mean, the case law is clear in Gilpin, on which the Lofton case relies, the Merck case, on which Gilpin cites. The very first question the court must decide is, does the Secretary have authority? It is only after a determination is made that there is authority that you can reach the second question of, is it therefore, having that authority, a reasonable gap-filling measure? And we do not dispute here the case law in Lofton, where the Federal Circuit found it was a reasonable gap-filling
measure. But if it is gap-filling, if you follow the logic that you've just said it's gap-filling, and the Secretary, we're just assuming, has the authority, right? If it is gap-filling, then it's not clear that Congress overruled or declared that the common law doesn't apply. Otherwise, it wouldn't be gap-filling.
Right. In order to get to gap-filling, you must have found that there was authority.
Forget the authority. Secretary still doesn't have the authority. Accept the rule. Accept the argument made that he only has the authority to do procedural rules.
Yes.
He can't write a substantive rule.
Correct.
Given the question you had before, you said under that scenario, then we would agree if the Secretary had the authority, then it would be gap-filling under the statute as it exists.
If
it's gap-filling under the statute that exists, it means that Congress has not spoken in that area.
There is a gap.
That's right.
Well, we're under the presumption that the Secretary has substantive rulemaking authority under this statute, that would be correct.
But then he would be filling a gap.
If that was true, position, Your Honor, is
but if
in
there
this
is
situation,
a gap, if there is a gap, except there's a gap and he doesn't have the authority to fill it.
The question of whether there's a gap only comes after there's a determination that the Secretary had the authority to promulgate the regulation. You don't look at the regulation and its reasonableness until you determine whether the Secretary has authority.
I believe Judge Sholin has given you a hypothetical. The hypothetical is we've determined that a regulation by the Secretary on this statute would be gap-filling, and he doesn't have the authority to gap-fill. But the question that was asked, and that came out confusing, I admit. The question that was asked was, assuming that he did not have the authority, or did have the authority, would there be a gap filling if he put this regulation into effect? And you've said yes a number of times. And my point is, forget the authority for a second. If he had the authority, he can only fill where there is a gap. And if there is a gap, that means that common law has not been abrogated. Because if it was abrogated, there would be no gap. Congress would have said, no, you cannot put this regulation into effect. So
If the common law was abrogated, I think that assumes the question of authority by the Secretary.
It assumes the question that there is no gap.
Or it assumes the question that the Secretary had authority to issue the regulation.
No, I think you've jumped over the gap now.
Now, Your Honor, in other situations in this statutory scheme, the Secretary has been given authority, express authority, and we mentioned in our brief Section 1315, where the Secretary is given express authority.
Let me put it another way. If common law was not abrogated by Congress, if there truly is a gap, then why wouldn't the Secretary have the authority to promulgate procedural regulations to put into force the common law?
Well, here, this is not and cannot be said to be a procedural regulation. Because
if common law exists and common law, the Slayer law, applies, why couldn't he procedurally write a regulation to put into effect the common law?
Well, in this situation, in Section 1318, there's an express statutory provision that accepts out classes of people, and the presumption under Gardner is that no other classes of people are accepted where one class of people is accepted. But based on that analysis of the statute, then, there would be abrogation. There is
so
no
there
authority.
Would be no gap.
And therefore, there would be no gap because the Secretary has no authority, correct?
Well, okay.
Let's go to your argument that you've been desperately trying to make, which is that VA doesn't have the authority to make substantive rulemaking. I'm a little confused by the statute's 501's reference to 553 of the APA, which specifically talks about when making substantive rules, these are procedures you need to follow, except when certain things happen. Why would 501 specifically refer to 553 of the APA without specifying a subsection or limiting it in any way if it didn't intend for the secretary to also have substantive rulemaking, since 553 controls substantive rulemaking as well?
Well, I think the answer to that lies in what has been specifically delegated to the secretary under 501, and what is expressly enumerated in 501A is where the secretary can issue regulations, irrespective of a global reference to the APA. And all of sections A, 1, 2, 3, 4 identify areas of procedure and not of substance, and in particular, not the ability of the secretary to exclude classes of people from getting benefits.
But the word that precedes those specific enumerated examples is including.
That's true, and the statute further says that the secretary has the authority to prescribe all rules and regulations.
Right.
And we don't dispute that. It's a broad power. But those four specifically enumerated subsections detail what those are, those types of regulations.
How do you get there when the preface is including?
Well, it is true, but what Section 501 is not is the ability of the secretary to issue any regulation at all that affects benefits under the statutory scheme. If that was the case, then Gardner may have been decided differently. I mean, Gardner said where you have a mandatory statutory provision and you specifically exclude a class of people.
Gardner really dealt with 501A. The secretary has authority to prescribe all rules and regulations which are necessary, appropriate to carry out the laws administered by the department and are consistent with those laws. The Gardner argument was it was inconsistent with the laws. Here you have a situation where, I mean, on the one hand, you say the secretary doesn't have the authority to fill a gap. On the other hand, you say there is a gap. And then on the other hand, you say there's no gap because he doesn't have the authority to fill the gap. Either there's a gap or there's not a gap.
Well, Your Honor, let me go back if I was unclear. Here, our position is the secretary does not have the authority.
No.
So whether or not there is a gap is really irrelevant because the secretary doesn't have the authority to do anything about it. If the secretary doesn't have the authority to issue the regulation, irrespective of whether there's a gap or even how reasonable the regulation may be, the secretary has not been given the authority to issue the regulation.
It seems to me, Counselor, your argument is that its regulation is not consistent with the law. That's really the underlying argument you're trying to make. You're putting it under a lot of titles. But that would be the only reason the secretary would not be able to promulgate the regulation.
Well, it is, Your Honor, inconsistent with 1318B, which specifically exempts a class of people.
And because it's inconsistent, he doesn't have the authority to issue it.
Correct.
Counsel, let me, I'm kind of a plain old country lawyer. I just like to look at things in a very practical standpoint. And the impact of your position is that if a spouse shoots his or her husband and kills his or her husband, then the surviving spouse has to be paid indemnity compensation.
Under
period.
That's correct. And under the current statute and the mandatory language of the statute and the exception out of the class of people, that is correct.
That baffles my mind. That's the practical impact of your argument.
That is correct, and we don't dispute that. The question is one of statutory authority and whether or not the secretary has been given the authority to issue the regulation that was issued.
Do you have any legislative history or authority that would indicate that Congress would want that result, knowing that common law would say that that would not be the result?
There's no legislative history on point on this issue, Your Honor.
But you still argue that Congress overruled common law in that area?
We did, based on the language of the statute, where one class
can
is
can you
accepted.
Present any position or argument that would convince someone that that makes sense?
Well, the question is the authority of the secretary again. And the secretary has been given substantive rulemaking authority, the authority to issue substantive regulations that affect classes of benefits in other situations and not here.
Well, I have to say, this is a political environment, but that was not an answer to the question. Could it be that the veteran has served his country and that the benefits are for the veteran and that regardless of the situation that the veteran would intend a spouse to have it?
Well, that's true, and that comes back to the statute being written in a mandatory way. I mean, the statute says the benefits shall be awarded under certain circumstances.
But then that conflicts what might be most people's thoughts or the common law that if somebody got killed by another person, they wouldn't want them to benefit.
Well, you could make that argument, Your Honor, but the statute...
You're out of time, but did you have...
One follow-up question to Judge Castle's line of inquiry, and that is... can you point to any legislative history that suggests Congress intended to overwrite the common law Slayer's rule?
As I said, there is no legislative history on this point. This issue is not addressed in legislative history.
All right. And I'm going to exercise and ask one additional question on your second argument. Your second argument is that the board did not review the evidence, did not consider all of the evidence.
That's right.
It's not a reasons and basis argument.
That's correct. And the board said in its decision that it was only relying on Section 3.11 to deny the benefits. The board expressly said it was not considering the evidence.
Thank you.
Well,
thank you.
If I may, to follow up with that as well, if I recall the board's decision, let me ask you this question, counsel. In the record on page one.
Can you add 5 minutes to this and we'll accommodate the secretary if additional time is needed.
Page three of the record, which is the board's decision. I'll give you a moment to have that handy.
I have it, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry, page three of the board's decision?
I'm sorry, page three of the record. Which may be page three of the board's decision as well. I think it is.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have it.
Okay. Under reasons and basis for findings and conclusion?
Yes.
The board says it has thoroughly reviewed all the evidence in the veterans' claims folders. Although the board has an obligation to provide reasons and basis supporting this decision, there is no need to discuss in detail the extensive evidence submitted by the appellant or on her behalf. And if you look further over on page 8 of the board's decision and the record on appeal, the board concludes, therefore, based solely on her conviction of manslaughter, she would be barred by the VA regulation from receiving DIC. So is the board, in your view, saying that it, in fact, did consider all the evidence and still is basing the conviction solely on the manslaughter?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Basing its decision solely on the manslaughter conviction?
That's correct.
So in your view, the board did review all the evidence before it?
Well, the board does say that in its decision, but says it's basing its decision solely on the conviction and doesn't address or discuss any of the other evidence and says it's basing its decision solely on the conviction.
And therefore, there's error because of what?
Because the board did not consider the totality of the evidence before. It did not.
Although it said it did.
In reaching its ultimate conclusion, denying the benefits, the board says, based solely on her conviction. That's the only issue that is addressed or considered in the opinion itself, is that the appellant pled nolo, was convicted, and that alone, based on this regulation, would preclude benefits.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. I'd like to first address my opponents pointing out the specific language in 1310 regarding shall. And I would note, direct the Court's attention to the language of 1310, which is virtually identical to 1318 in terms of requiring that the Secretary shall pay if the two are satisfied. And in Lofton, although 1310 was the DIC basis that provided the Court with the opportunity to analyze the validity of 3.11. However, 3.11 operates identically as a gap-filling measure with respect to both 1310 and 1318 DIC, Your Honors. So we don't believe that there's any meaningful distinction between the two in 3.11's operation. And we believe that the language of Lofton broadly covers DIC benefits generally. But even if this Court finds that the broad language of the Lofton analysis applies, but doesn't address 1318 specifically, we believe that the strength of the Court's analysis in Lofton inevitably leads to the conclusion that 3.11 is a valid regulation as to 1318 DIC as well. Secondly, Your Honors, I'd like to address my opposing counsel's reference to the specific statutory authority to rulemake in some statutes as opposed to 501 and the reference that she infers from that. Your Honors, however, 501 leaves substantial deference to the Secretary to determine when to employ his rulemaking authority. However, we acknowledge that at times Congress has not left whether to issue rule regulations within the Secretary's discretion. And in such situations, it has actually required the Secretary to rulemake by using the word shall or similar language right in the statutes. And we would refer to the Court to the very examples that opposing counsel included in their briefs. Congress chooses when to allow the Secretary to rulemake and when to require the Secretary to rulemake, Your Honors, and it has chosen to do both at different times. Appellant's argument betrays a fundamental misunderstanding of the important distinction between authority with discretion and authority with a mandate. Your Honors, we'd like to turn to the regulatory challenge that that appellant has put forward. In her brief, she argues that she meets the requirements of DIC, that the Secretary didn't have the authority to promulgate 3.11, and that existing law is not controlling. However, appellant's regulatory challenge is based on a false dichotomy that the Secretary's regulatory authority under 501 is limited to what she categorizes as procedural rather than substantive rules, but that is not what the courts have held. And in looking at the actual language of 501, we see that the Secretary has authority to prescribe all rules and regulations which are necessary or appropriate to carry out the laws that it administers.
Counsel, yes, if I may, could you address the position of appellant's counsel regarding the mandatory statutory language and the practical impact of a spouse shooting a veteran and necessarily being paid benefits?
When you say the mandatory statutory...
The language that appellant's counsel indicated was mandatory, that the requirements are limited to two conditions, and those conditions were met.
Oh, in 1318,
Your Honor? In 1318, right.
Your Honor, we believe that that appellant is making an unreasonable jump, inferring that because there are a couple of examples in 1318 that somehow the Secretary didn't have authority to gap fill. But, Your Honor, we would point out that the same gap that existed in 1310 that the Lofton Court found the Slayer's rule was reasonably adopted and filled exists in 1318 as well, Your Honor. And we don't believe that the language of 1318 somehow makes this case different in terms of 3.11's operation.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that Lofton shouldn't apply here because it had not considered 501 and the Secretary's authority to create such regulations?
Your Honor, we believe that that is a self-serving and narrow interpretation of Lofton. Appellant is trying to sidestep the application of Lofton, but if this Court looks at the actual language of Lofton, what we see is that the broad language of the Lofton analysis dooms those efforts because the Court after very carefully indicating the arguments that the appellant in that case had raised that set the court up for its opportunity to review the validity of the regulation, the court did specifically analyze the case under Gilpin, which is a Chevron analysis case. And so the court began by noting that that this is a gap-filling case, Your Honor. And then the court went on to explain that the department does have the authority to promulgate rules as long as they're not contrary to congressional enactments. And a regulation, the court found, does not contradict the statutory scheme simply because it addresses an issue on which the scheme is silent. As long as the regulation constitutes a reasonable gap-filling measure, VA may promulgate the rule without violating its statutory mandate. And, Your Honors, that's exactly what the department did, and that's exactly what the Lofton court found. Now, in turning to the...
Before you go on, didn't the Lofton court also find that the common law had not been abrogated by the congressional statutes in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, it did. It did. In fact, the Lofton court very clearly stated that Congress is presumed to legislate against a common law background. And then the court went on to explain the universality of the common law Slayer's rule before finding that VA reasonably adopted the Slayer's rule into its regulations in light of that common law background.
Counsel, do you have any indication or evidence that the legislative history suggests that the Congress meant to overwrite the common law Slayer's rule here?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that there's...
Or not.
Your Honor, in evaluating the legislative history, we were not able to find anything that would suggest that Congress intended to overrule the common law, as it has very, very, for many, many years, provided the Slayer's rule. And so we think that it's important, it's informative that the Lofton court found the fact that Congress legislates against a common law background important. We would also note that, although it's not determinative, the fact that a regulation has been in place for many years while Congress actively legislated is informative, and as Congress would likely have addressed a rule that was inconsistent with the statutory scheme. And, Your Honors, that's been discussed in Federal Circuit cases, and we would invite the Court's attention to the Sears case at 349 F3rd 1326, which is a 2003 case. Your Honor, I'd like to, address a point that Judge Scholin raised, and that was all this discussion about inferences and legal principles. It seems that, in a way, this is an artifice by appellant to draw the court's attention away from the very clear language of the statute. And, Your Honors, we would point out that it's important when looking at a question of statutory interpretation and the meaning of a statute to actually look at the language of the statute as a whole, including other statutes that statute touches upon. That is basic statutory construction analysis. And what we notice is the point that Judge Scholin raised is that when Congress purposefully enacted 501, it did so in a way that combined in one statute the Secretary's broad rulemaking authority and the specific application to veterans' benefits regulations of the Administrative Procedures Act's substantive rulemaking requirements that are contained in 5 U.S.C. 553. Since 553, notice and comment rulemaking applies to substantive rulemaking only and not to interpretive or procedural rules, Congress's intentional addition of 501D only makes sense if 501 includes substantive rulemaking authority. And similarly, Your Honors, as part of the same enactment, we would note that Congress also added 501C, which makes clear that VA must comply with the APA's 5 U.S.C. 552A1D's requirement that VA publish in the Federal Register, among other things, substantive rules of general applicability. So the clear language of 501 itself, read in proper context, gives the Secretary the authority to promulgate the regulations. Your Honors, appellant's arguments here, if accepted by this court, would not only undermine much of the regulatory scheme that is in place, and there have been a number of examples where the courts have upheld the Secretary's 501 substantive rulemaking authority, But in addition to undermining the much of the regulatory scheme, appellant's argument as to 3.11 in cases that it would otherwise apply to would allow murderers to get DIC benefits after killing veterans. And, Your Honors, we believe that that is an absurd result.
I'd like to turn to the appellant's factual argument. You concede, the Secretary concedes that this case should be remanded back to the board on the basis of, I believe, that the board didn't consider all the factors that the regional council thought that they should have considered in their decision-making. What is the authority structure? I know the board is bound by general counsel opinions. What kind of authority or power does a regional counsel's opinion have within the agency?
Your Honor, of course, as you pointed out, the department is bound by the general counsel opinions. And so here, with respect to the general counsel opinion of 1988, that certainly applied to the whole department. Now, with respect to the regional council letters in this case, those are not binding on VA adjudicators, Your Honors, as they're not the policy issuances of the general counsel. However, as to the appellant's claim, they certainly provided sound guidance to the adjudicators on how to address this case. And they were consistent with the laws and the regulations, and the approach that they urged should have been followed, Your Honors, based on their prudence, if not their precedence.
Counsel, on page 8 and 9, following up on Judge Sholin's question, is where in your brief, you conclude, ultimately the board concluded, based solely on her conviction of manslaughter, she would be barred by VA regulation from receiving DIC. And then you stated the board's reliance upon the appellant's conviction alone as the determinative factor is not sustainable. So referring back to the record references, the same question I asked appellant's counsel on page 3 and page 8, where initially on page 3 the board says it's reviewed all the evidence, and then page 8 says it relies solely or something along those lines. Is it your position that the board did not, apparently it is, your position that the board did not appropriately consider all of the evidence or totality of the circumstances? Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, we believe that
I want to get a clarification, because we've used the words consider, and your brief uses the words reasons and basis. Are you rejecting the board's statement that it considered all of the evidence, or are you sticking by your brief, which says that perhaps, in your view, the statement of reasons and basis was inadequate?
Your Honor, we would note that we believe that the ultimate determination in the board's decision is based, as they put it, it was essentially a matter of law based on the conviction.
And why do you get to that?
Because, Your Honor, based on page 8, last paragraph, top sentence, it says, therefore, based solely on her conviction of manslaughter,
and what does that follow? What does that sentence follow? Doesn't it follow an entire discussion of the elements of manslaughter?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
Don't the elements of manslaughter include intent?
The elements of Florida manslaughter can include intent. They also include culpable negligence.
And doesn't Florida interpret or define culpable negligence as the equivalent of intent?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what part of this statement from the board do you not find that this board hearing officer, independent of the secretary, made a determination that there was intent in this case after he said he reviewed and weighed all of the facts?
Your Honor, again, I would point you to the invite the court's attention to that last sentence where it says, based solely on her conviction of manslaughter. And we do not believe
that... It
says,
therefore, based solely on a conviction of manslaughter. Therefore, meaning after all of my discussion, all of the board's discussion about what this entails to get a particular conviction, I've considered all the facts, we have this conviction, and therefore, based on all of that, that would be sufficient because what the reg says, intent and wrongfulness.
We believe that that seems inconsistent with the board's earlier statements that it considered the evidence and yet didn't discuss in detail the evidence that that it was basing its decision on, Your Honor. It seemed there was some inconsistency in the board's decision. We believe that a reasonable reading of it, though, implied or strongly suggested that it basically looked to the conviction to determine whether 3.11 was satisfied. And we believe that under these circumstances, based on the NOLO plea and the inadequate record development, that that didn't provide a factual basis for the full determination.
So some of the factors they should have discovered or discussed would have been the conflicting evidence that the appellant asserted to?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
We believe that they should have discussed, first of all, we believe that VA should have more thoroughly developed the evidence in this case.
How does this differ from Lofton, where the Federal Circuit said that the conviction established as a matter of law intentional and wrongful killing?
Because in that case, Your Honor, that conviction did establish as a matter of law. The actual factual background of Lofton in this case are very different. In Lofton, the appellant was someone who, after
Can you have a conviction for manslaughter in Florida law without the intent?
I'm no expert in Florida law, but based upon my my reading of it, Your Honor, it appears that that is probably not the case. It seems that under Florida law, culpable negligence essentially satisfies the intentional requirement under Florida's
law. So why doesn't that conviction serve as a matter of law to establish intent and wrongful killing?
Because, Your Honor, it is not VA's position that that on the question of whether the elements of 3.11 are satisfied, that it should be bound by the findings of a state criminal court. Rather, 7104A requires that that
the Federal Circuit was wrong in Lofton?
Your Honor, the Federal Circuit, the Federal Circuit's finding with respect to the matter of law in that case, I think bears out more the distinction between the two cases. In Lofton, the appellant had never claimed that she hadn't killed the veteran. In fact, in Lofton, she admitted that after attempting to have him prosecuted for molesting the daughter unsuccessfully, she had become very frustrated.
But Lofton does say, as the Board of Veterans Appeals correctly noted, Mrs. Lofton's conviction, not her plea, conviction established as a matter of law that she intentionally and wrongfully killed Mr. Lofton. Now, here you have no contender, but you have a judge finding on the facts manslaughter and conviction, rendering conviction.
Because, Your Honor, in Lofton, the conviction was based upon the admissions of the appellant. Here we have an appellant who has never admitted to killing her husband. Rather, she has consistently professed her innocence since 1985. In fact, her nolo contendere plea in the Florida court system, which does not have to be accompanied by a providency inquiry, was specifically accompanied by a profession of innocence. And therefore, Your Honor, respecting the law of nolo contendere and trying
so
to harmonize...
So what's our review of the board decision?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What's our review of the board decision here?
What is your
is
review?
It clearly erroneous?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that we had suggested remand based on reasons and bases because of the inconsistency and what appeared to be the board's reliance almost exclusively.
The board's reasons are pretty clear, are they not? They analyzed what manslaughter was in under Florida law. They stated that they reviewed all the facts. They said that there must be the intent established within the Florida law conviction, and then found that there was, in that case, a sufficient evidence of legal justification. It was sufficient to convict. Based solely on conviction of manslaughter, benefits could be denied. It then went through to show that it wasn't relying simply on the conviction. It went through and discussed pardon and the whole meaningfulness of the pardon, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
What part of the board decision is not understandable?
We believe that the board decision was based on a record that was not fully developed, and there are inconsistencies in the board decision with respect
to... What's our review of the board's determination that it did fully develop the facts?
That would be based on the clearly erroneous standard, Your Honor.
Are you saying the board is clearly erroneous?
We are acknowledging that there was board error in the analysis of this case and recommending...
Can you acknowledge that on behalf of the board? Isn't that an independent entity?
Can we acknowledge error in a board decision, Your Honor?
You can suggest it was error. You can say in your view it was error.
And that's all that we can, and that's all that we have done, Your Honor. Your Honors, again, we would point out the absurdity of the result if 3.11 is found to be an invalid regulation. We believe that that would be contrary to the Federal Circuit's finding in Lofton. It would be contrary to the substantive rulemaking authority contained in 501, which has been expressly acknowledged by the Federal Circuit. We would point out the Degmatich case in Headnote 8 and many other cases by the Federal Circuit in this court also. Your Honors, if there is nothing further, we would ask that the court remand the case in conjunction with our brief.
Counsel, I have a question, hypothetically, and it's more of a policy question, I suppose. Would 3.11 better serve the department if it followed state law?
Your Honor, I believe that it might conflict with the statute 7104A if it were to. If 3.11 simply said that VA was bound by state court convictions, that would seem to conflict with the requirement that Congress wrote into 7104A that decisions on VA claims for benefits were to be based on all the evidence of record. And we believe that that is harmonized in the GC opinion of 1988, Your Honor. Are there no further questions?
Thank you. That's all then. You have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to go back, Your Honor, to the question of Lofton. And before I do, the Supreme Court, in its Adams decision, has said a precondition of Chevron deference is the delegation of authority. That delegation of authority to make substantive rules or substantive regulations. So a precondition to that deference. And, Your Honor, the deference, the Chevron deference, is what is discussed in the Lofton decision. But a precondition of that is authority. And the Lofton case does not say, and does not expressly say, where the authority in the statutory scheme is given to the secretary to enact a regulation that restricts the class of benefits. Counsel argued that the Gilpin case, which the Lofton case relies on, for that proposition. But Gilpin is different, Your Honors. In Gilpin, there was a different statutory scheme, and in Gilpin, that statute expressly gave substantive rulemaking authority to the secretary. In particular, Your Honors, the secretary was given the authority to identify additional diseases for which benefits could be given. So that statute is quite distinct from the statute that was addressed in Gilpin. Furthermore, the distinction between substantive and procedural rulemaking is real and has been recognized by the Federal Circuit. For example, in the Merck decision, in Merck, which is discussed in Gilpin, the Federal Circuit makes a distinction, and a clear one, between substantive and procedural rulemaking. In that case, it was not the VA, but the Patent and Trademark Office. There, the statute said that the commissioner had the ability to make procedures. And what the Federal Circuit said is that's all the commissioner had. Because of that delegation of authority, the commissioner could not enact substantive.
Why aren't these procedures implementing the common law?
Your Honor, I would go back then to the statutory language itself.
Because you say Congress abrogated the common law.
That's right.
And then what about the Federal Circuit that specifically stated, in light of the universality of the common law rule and the fact that Congress did not foreclose its application? I mean, should we just ignore that? Is that dicta?
It is, Your Honor, because in Lofton, the court was not deciding and did not decide the authority to enact the regulation. It was not reached in that decision. In Lofton, the only thing that's addressed is gap filling, and as the Supreme Court said in Adams, a precondition to Chevron deference, that is gap filling, is the delegation of authority.
I'm going to go back once more, Counselor. Either it's gap filling or it's not. And the secretary assumed they have the authority to fill the gap. They still could not promulgate this rule if the statute had abrogated the common law. If the statute had abrogated the common law and had the shell, and it was limited to only the conditions in the statute, then the secretary isn't filling in any gap. He's going contrary to the statute.
That's correct.
All right. The Federal Circuit stated that Congress did not abrogate the common law and that the secretary could fill in the gap. Now, you're arguing that he can't fill in the gap, and the Federal Circuit never addressed the gap. But that is a separate argument from whether or not the common law was abrogated. So once again, the Federal Circuit has told us it was not abrogated. What is your position, that we can somehow ignore this because it's dicta?
It is dicta, Your Honor. The Federal Circuit does not specifically address the authority in this statute or in the statute at issue in the Lochtin case to enact a substantive rule restricting benefits where the statute already includes provisions restricting benefits but is silent. And, Your Honor, I'd also point out, with respect to Section 501, this Court's decision in Lee looked at an additional requirement added by regulation that was not included in the statute. And this Court found that there was no authority to issue the regulation. And furthermore, this Court looked at Section 501 and said...
So let me go back then again. If we follow the Federal Circuit and common law was not abrogated, why isn't this just a procedural rule putting into effect the common law?
Your Honor, by virtue of Section 1318, a mandatory provision says that benefits shall be provided. By that provision...
And then abrogated. Okay, I got your position.
If there are no further questions, that's all.
Oh.
Thank you very much.
The case will be submitted.
All rise. And we will bring counsel.
Honorable Court is adjourned to further order.